Okay, might as well start now. Again, it was a request for this evening's talk, and it was especially about Buddhism and teenagers. And don't worry that you may be in your 60s or 70s. Like me, you were a teenager once, so hopefully that you can understand and appreciate some of the things which I'm going to be talking about. I know that people think that teenagers aren't really interested in religion at all, but I always recall a psychologist telling me of some research amongst young people who say that when our boys and girls get towards the age of 15 or 16, they become very sensitive towards spirituality. Instead of calling it religion, call it spirituality. It's a time in their lives when their mind is opening up. They're not just interested in the other gender, they're also interested in just the meaning of life. And they will be seeking somewhere, somebody who gives their life some meaning. Obviously, sometimes that's in music, sometimes that's in a few beginnings of relationships. But it's also that spirituality is something which they are open for. If it is presented in an interesting, entertaining and fun way, because kids would hate getting bored, just like you guys hate getting bored. It's one of the reasons why people keep coming to this center, because every now and again I tell a few jokes, funny stories, to make it interesting. The last thing you want is to come to a place and just fall asleep. And that's the same with kids. I mean, they don't fall asleep these days, they just get onto their smartphones and text each other. But certainly they're not paying attention. So it's kids, they do like some spirituality, but one of the problems is it may be put in the wrong way. And especially for those of you who are coming from an Asian background, you have to make a difference between culture and spirituality. Culture really turns our teenagers off, because they're trying to find their own culture, basically trying to improve on things, which is marvelous, questioning things. And culture is sometimes something far too rigid. It doesn't really fit the teenager that well. So, first of all, please make that difference between culture and spirituality. And part of that culture for many Asian Buddhists is things like, is it respect for your parents? It's wonderful if you've got kids respect you, but obviously you have to earn that respect, and sometimes that respect goes too far, where the kids have to ask their parents for everything. It's like the story I read the other day, about this poor kid always trying to find a partner in life. Whenever he brought a new girlfriend home, his mother never liked her. Never good enough for my son. And so eventually he asked his a friend and said, get someone who's much more like your mum. And then maybe, they might get on. So he looked around and found someone just exactly like his own mother and brought her home, and that relationship didn't last either. The mum loved her, but his father couldn't stand her. So you can't please your parents. So sometimes that wanting to have respect from your kids, sometimes you've got to earn that respect and give them a bit of understanding and freedom. But the spirituality part of it is important, because this psychologist said around that age, 15, 16, 17, our kids are very interested in spirituality. They want to give something which gives their life some meaning and answers some of the difficult questions in life. And what's really attractive with a teaching like Buddhism, it's not so negative, it doesn't put people down. At least it shouldn't be putting people down. Because I always feel I feel a lot of sympathy for children, just the way they speak to each other and the way they're spoken to by their parents. Still remember in the olden days, I remember coming from some place in the western suburbs, I think I was giving a talk at a school and I had a bus ticket, so I got a bus back to here on a Friday afternoon to give the talk. And I just happened to be sitting behind two girls as they were coming home from school. These are obviously close friends, maybe about 14 or 15. And just listening to the way that young schoolgirls talk to each other. And one said to the other, yeah, you'll never get a boyfriend. You got your breasts are too flat and your nose is too big, said the other one. And they went on like this for all about 20, 25 minutes when I was listening to them. And if this is how friends talk to each other, imagine what enemies would say to each other. You poor kids at school, you know, you never, never, never get enough praise, not even from your friends. And so sometimes I feel sorry for our teenagers. They catch it from their friends, they catch it from their teachers unless they get straight A's, they catch it from their parents when they get home. These poor kids are never good enough. And I can't resist telling the old story that I knew that. I was sensitive enough that when I was a school teacher, now, I could never really be too critical of the kids because I knew what they would get from the other teachers, whether from their parents, even their friends. I'd always try and build them up no matter what they were doing. And of course, a famous story when I was teaching my class, I only was a teacher for 1 year, there was one of the children in my class came bottom of the class. Have you ever come bottom of the class? I had a class of 30 children and this poor boy came 30th. In the class of 30. And I could imagine what he was going to get from his parents that night. So I wasn't going to let that happen without sort of helping this poor kid. I'm compassionate. You're supposed to be kind. Build up people. Teach them some spirituality. So I went up to this kid after I'd given out the results for the end of the year exam. It was only like 14-year-olds, what's that, grade 9s or grade 10s or something? Not really that important. And, you know, when he found out he came 30th, he looked really miserable and upset. So I went up to him and I decided to teach him some Buddhism, some spirituality. Especially I taught him about the idea in Buddhism of the Bodhisattva. A Bodhisattva is a being who sacrifices their own happiness so others won't have to suffer. And I said that you are like this Bodhisattva, that this year, intentionally, deliberately, on purpose, you decided to become bottom of the class so none of your friends will have to suffer what you're going to get this evening from your mum and dad. All these other kids are so selfish, all they ever do is think about themselves and their grades, and you think of other people. You are the real Buddhist. You're the Bodhisattva. You are the person who's going to do really well in this world. I told him, I'm going to put your name forward to the principal, to the headmaster, to get this year's Bodhisattva Award Prize. And I'm just putting it in a different way. So you come bottom of the class, so what? But I always told him, this is one of the most important things I told him. I said, but, you know, you can only get the Bodhisattva Prize once in your school career. Don't do it again. But straight away, I was giving him some spirituality. Yeah, you came bottom of the class, so what? Is that the end of the world? Why focus on the faults? Why not focus on other things in your character, not just your school results? Is your school results the be-all and end-all of success in life? Isn't there something more important? That's what I'm trying to teach the teenagers. It's not just about your grades. And, you know, you tell that great book by the Buddhist Daniel Goleman, Emotional Intelligence, is a classic book which showed that people who do well in life are not just the people who get straight A's and go to good universities and get, you know, these first-class honours. Just because you do that doesn't mean you're successful in life. Look at me. No wife, no family, no money, no assets. It's not those people who do well in life. The people who do well in life are the people who have this emotional intelligence, who have these things called resilience. So you become bottom of the class. How about looking at something else? So your team loses the match. So your girlfriend dumps you. My girlfriend dumped me many times. Actually, not the same girlfriend, only different girlfriends dumped me. But, you know, I dumped a few of them as well. Fair enough. You know, it's karma. Works its way around. But, you know, so what? So that resilience is something you get, which we call the emotional intelligence And that is what we want to try and impart on our kids. It's not just in school. School is so one-eyed. Education, just passing exams, is all you teaches you. Can't it be something more? You know, a long time ago, if there's anyone from the education department here, sometimes it's like banging my head on a brick wall. But nevertheless, keep on saying this. Why is it that at our schools we always praise and reward personal achievement and never the ability to cooperate with others? Why is it that when, say, your kids do the year 12 exams, they are competing against their best friend? Isn't that really rotten? It's maybe a person you've grown up with, you love them, you care for them, your best friend, and you just can't share information. You've got to compete together for the university place. We reward competition in our education system so much that we're very good at competing, but hopeless at cooperating. When we go to the work, the office, yeah, we can do our own work, but we can't assist other people. When we get married, yeah, we're so selfish, we don't know how to work with another person, with another man, with another woman. We know how to compete, but never how to cooperate. So my suggestion, just, you know, why not? You know, I always think these things out of the box. Why not at every year, especially at universities, especially year 12, 70%, may I just say 70% or 60% of your final score is your personal marks, what you've actually done in the exams. And the other 30% is averaged over the whole class to which you belong, which means you get rewarded by helping others in your own class. The whole class, their achievement is an important part of your own final mark. Thereby, we reward cooperation. That kids in the class who are really good at one subject, very strong, spend time helping out those children who aren't so good. They have to do that because they're going to get rewarded. They're going to get to university or they're going to fail if one of the weak kids fails. So when we're rewarding cooperation, we're encouraging cooperation, we learn the skills of cooperation, and my goodness, when we go to the workforce, we can cooperate with someone in the office who's weak at one thing, we're strong in it, we can help them out. In life, when we have a family, we can learn how to work together instead of competing all the time. So those are actually little spiritual things which we can add, you know, to the experiences of our teenagers, which will make their world a better place and also will make, you know, our world a better place when they graduate and they get into the workforce, when they get married, when they have their friends. They're not so competing to be the best all the time. It really is hopeless trying to be the best all the time. So hard being a monk, trying to be the best monk. I gave that up a long time ago. Trying to tell the best jokes. And I find another monk tells funnier jokes than I am. We don't try and, you know, be the best. We're trying to cooperate, you know, in a monastery. This is the emotional skills which we learn. And this is actually a lot of things which our teenagers want. A lot of times all they need to be is respected, to be built up, just not to be criticized when they fail. To get that little resilience, you know, so they know how to deal with the difficulties in life. And something like Buddhism, which is just so non-judgmental, should be really helping our children. You know, it's don't care who you are, what you do. You know, if you're not so good, you're the Bodhisattva. If you're very, very good, you know, or the Arahat, whatever it is, you know, you win in Buddhism. You get enlightened this week, or you get enlightened in your next life, you're very, very good. This is one of the important things where we don't judge people. And instead we respect people. A lot of the judging is always coming from this, what we call in Buddhism, the fault-finding mind. So we teach our teenagers, don't develop a fault-finding mind. Develop the opposite, which is a mind of appreciation and gratitude, which can see the beauty in things. Even once again, just this evening, I told the old story, which keeps coming up because it's a great story of the two bad bricks in the wall. If you haven't heard that story before, where have you been? It's in the internet, it's in the books, even Amnesty International apparently printed that out. But, you know, in brief, Why was it that when I built my first wall, I saw the two bad bricks and wanted to destroy the whole wall because they spoiled the whole wall? That's what I thought, until someone said, can you not see the bricks on the left, the right, above, below, the other 998 good bricks in the wall, not just the two bad bricks? And have you ever noticed, like I had to notice, why is it that you have a fault and that's all you can see? You just can't see anything else. And why is it you need to be taught? Doesn't matter what mistake you've made, there's 998 beautiful things as well. Why do we just look at the faults? That is the emotional intelligence we can teach our kids. Yeah, you may have failed one exam, but it doesn't matter, you haven't failed life. Yeah, you know, the boyfriend has dumped you. That's just one bad brick. A guy who's so stupid doesn't appreciate you. Just, you don't really want him. Why do that? You try and get a job in life. You know, this. And sometimes, I don't know how many people, they got a job in life and they always think their boss is stupid. But if you got a boss and you think he's stupid, remember, if he wasn't that stupid, he wouldn't have hired you. Oh, that's a bit cynical. But I did read that in a book as well, of bad jokes. We can, instead of look at the negative side of life, we can look at the positive side of life. And that's, again, with kids, with teenagers, for goodness sake. You know, what I try to do, trying to find the most beautiful girl to date. You can't do that. Trying to find a beautiful one was almost impossible. I could never find them. There was always something wrong with them. Until one day I looked in the mirror and said, well, there's something wrong with me as well, so what beautiful girl will want me? And so I lowered my expectations. That way you had much more girlfriends. So, I mean, it's true, isn't it? You kids, the teenagers, I mean, they want a partner in life. Or at least they want a boyfriend or a girlfriend. But for goodness sake, lower your expectations. Have a look in the mirror. And then you realize, I better lower my expectations quick and get her to as well. Bring all your kids to the Buddhist society and get everyone to lower their expectations. And so everyone can have a nice time and have a nice partner in life. Because lowering your expectations is just realizing there are going to be two, three bad bricks in the wall, but beautiful bricks in the wall as well. And when you can do that for a kid, for a teenager, it's also the most important. They can see that in themselves as well. They don't have to be perfect to be happy with themselves. And of course, I'm talking to you now because you know that's probably been the story of your life. Never good enough. You're trying so hard for your parents because kids do love the parents. Don't ever think they don't. They really care for you, but sometimes they just don't show it. But they do. Just like you love your kids, sometimes you don't tell them. It's there. But sometimes we always feel the impression we come is always told off, always rejected. It's never good enough. And then you go out, you know, you find a partner and you're trying so hard to be pleasing to them, but it's never good enough. And you get a job and it's never good enough and they never think you're good enough. You become a monk and you're not good enough. Whatever it is, you're not good enough. You're not funny enough. You don't meditate long enough. You're not wise enough. There's always something you're not enough. And that is for many people's lives. They have been criticized and put down and let down so many times. They get really negative and upset about life. This is especially good to teach teenagers right from the very beginning in order not to sort of only look at the two bad bricks of life, not to look at the two bad bricks, you know, of themselves, to see the other beautiful things in themselves. You know, sometimes, you know, you may have a daughter, she's so concerned about her looks, and you say, you're beautiful, darling. That doesn't help at all, because they don't believe mum and dad. They want their boyfriend to say that, not you. But what you can do is to say, well, look, you can look at your face in the mirror, but there's always two bad bricks in there somewhere. Can't you see the other 998 good bricks? And in the other people, can't you see the beautiful part, not just the ugly part? Because you'll never be perfect, darling. No more than daddy or mummy is perfect. You never find a beautiful boy or girl who's perfect. You'll never get 100% in the exams. But that's not the purpose of life. The spirituality of life is actually to realize something more important. The most beautiful sunsets are the ones with imperfections, with the clouds or the dust on the horizon. You need that dust, those clouds, to spread the beautiful colors of gold and crimson on the horizon. You actually change your ideas of what perfection is. It's not just what is measured in the exam results. It's not what you can measure on the sort of the glossy magazine covers. That is not the definition of beauty. And once that is known by teenagers, it changes a lot of their attitudes towards life. They don't look for beauty in what is called perfection. They don't always have to be number one. Instead, they learn about this beautiful thing of compassion and kindness. It's compassion and kindness which makes people beautiful, not makeup. It's compassion and beautiful which makes people attractive, you know, not just expensive clothes. You know, expensive clothes and makeup, that can't hide the real person. So often with teenagers, a few times, you know, well, as a Buddhist monk, sometimes people put you in difficult situations. They say, come and give a talk. And sometimes it's, you know, to people you've never given a talk to before. I was invited in Kuala Lumpur. They say, you know, you're free this afternoon. Come and give a talk to this youth camp. And they had about 300 kids from 15 to 25. And I didn't know what on earth I was supposed to do, with no preparation at all. And so one of the things which I did do was actually separate them, boys and girls on one side, boys on one side, girls on the other side, sorry. And I did a very simple exercise. I said, okay, boys, you know, what type of girl turns you on? What girl is hot to you? And, no, you know, it was, I did this because I remember when I was growing up. I didn't know what I had to do. No one told me how to be attractive to a girl. You know, should I have expensive hairstyle, or should I wear sharp clothes? Should I be macho like Bruce Willis? What should I do? No one would ever tell me. And it's a waste of time asking my fellow boys. They were stupid as I was, and I was too scared to ask the girls. So this time I actually asked the girls, okay, what type of boy would you like? And all the boys were paying full attention. And it was, for them, it was such a relief. They did not have to get expensive clothes. They did not have to be a tough guy. They did not have to be violent to impress, you know, the opposite gender. What I got from the girls, I remember this, they said, and I've done this several times, it's the same sort of answers. They want someone who's fun to be with, trustworthy, kind. I think those were one of the three things which always stood out. You know, to be clean and be smart, but, you know, don't have to go overboard with, you know, sort of expensive suits and stuff. Now, just those three things I always remember. Trustworthy was important. Fun to be with and kind. That made them very attractive. And then when the boys took notes, then, okay, now the girls' time. So boys, you know, what do you like in a girl? Does she have to be really, really beautiful? Big boobs and nice long hair, whatever. What is it you really want? And they said the same thing, basically. Yeah, you know, they like an attractive girl, but what was really important for them, that they too had to be trustworthy. They'd been let down too many times, and they wanted, you know, a girl to be fun to be with, you know, not always putting them down, not always being dull, you know, to be fun to be with, and also to be kind. And that was such an important lesson for the kids to understand, that that is what is important in life, to have a partner. And that's also important to have a good relationship with yourself. To be trustworthy to yourself, to be kind to yourself, to be fun to be with yourself. I'm a lot of fun to be with when I'm up by myself. I know I practice jokes. And I laugh at my jokes more than anybody else. I see other monks, they catch me out sometimes. I enjoy my own company, I enjoy other people's company. I'm obviously very trustworthy. If I make a promise, I try and keep it. I really sometimes get, you know, into big trouble trying to keep my promises. You know, that's why sometimes I'm overseas. You know, people ask me, can you please come to Malaysia? I say, I can't come. And then they ask me again, can you please come? They keep on asking me. I have to say no 100 times. I only say once, yes once, and then I have to go. So it's really sort of, be careful. So, of course, you know these days, well, I told you all my tricks. When people invite me, can you please come to my house to do some chanting? I say, I'll think about it. That's a way out. I'm thinking about so many invitations, so many things I should be doing. I'm thinking about it. Sometimes it takes me years to finish thinking about it. But I can't say no, otherwise I get into big trouble. And if I say yes, I get into more trouble. So that's sometimes, so I am trustworthy, but that makes people very attractive and also brings them a lot of peace towards themselves. The way they look at themselves, the way they look at other people, exactly the same. So that is why that type of spirituality can really help, you know, human beings. And you know the other thing, which I remember from that conference, or that seminar, that we also asked, you know, these 15 to 25-year-olds in Kuala Lumpur, say, and it would be exactly the same result if we did this here. So what's your biggest emotional problem in your life? The biggest emotional problem in a teenager's life. You know the one which came out clear top? It was totally unexpected at the time, but once I heard it, I thought, wow, yes, I can understand why. Tiredness. Tiredness was the biggest problem of 15 to 25-year-olds. And the reason is because the amount of stuff they have to do. School, housework, cleaning up their rooms, and their social life. That really drags so much energy out of our young people. So now I've said that, you probably understand what one of the biggest problems with teenagers is. They are so tired, forcing themselves to live up to the expectations from their peers, from their school, and also from their parents. Which is one of the reasons, as soon as I saw that meditation, learning how to relax, just like you have your stress. Sometimes we think teenagers don't have stress, they don't have so much worries, but they, my goodness, they do, in their own ways. So when you teach teenagers how to meditate, they love it. You know, the first time I taught meditation was in 1972, I think. I'd become a school teacher. And at this high school in Devon, that, you know, the teachers in those days, we had to take the morning assembly, if you remember those in the old days. Morning assembly, the principal said the announcement, and one of the teachers had to do something religious. And it was my week to do the assembly. And so I got the principles okay on this. I said, I'll teach people how to meditate. So in this high school, 650 boys and girls from 11 years old to 18, this was in the UK, 11 years old, I said, okay, now we're going to teach you how to meditate. Now sit down, cross your legs, back straight, close your eyes, now watch your breath go in, go out, and for 5 minutes. And there was this amazing experience for two reasons. Number one, every child, 650 children, all followed my instructions. And number two, when it was finished, only 5 minutes, they burst into spontaneous applause. They'd never seen that before. And the teachers said, and they'd never seen that before either. And one of the teachers said, what would have happened if one of the kids started laughing? And I realized that as soon as one started, the whole 650 would have laughed. And they would have ridiculed me. But it was amazing that not one of them did that. And they all appreciated just 5 minutes of rest at the beginning of their school day. And of course now, from this perspective, I can imagine how they felt. Going to school, meeting your friends, you know, playing around in the playground beforehand, catching up. You know, you've just done your homework probably on the bus on the way to school, and you've got to face the teachers afterwards, is it? Stressful for kids in school, like it was for you. And so they do get tired. And a little bit of rest. They really got into that. And they appreciated it so much. That's why they applauded the whole 650 kids. It was an amazing experience for me. Didn't understand exactly why it happened, but now I do. And being able to teach a little bit of meditation to teenagers, incredible, powerful. They can rest. They can feel good about themselves. Their emotional intelligence really increases. You don't get emotional intelligence by teaching people, by giving them more lectures. They get that all day from their parents, from their teachers. They want to have some experience to enhance their emotional sensitivity. They've got to feel, you know, what's going on inside their body and mind at this incredibly powerful changing times of teenage years. They've got to get in touch with those emotions, feel them, understand them. And as soon as they can do things like that through some simple meditation, has huge effects. That's why kids love meditating. But you've got to teach at children's levels. When I was in Sri Lanka recently, they asked, how can you teach kids how to meditate? Young kids. And I brought my mind back to the early years when I came to Perth, when we used to meet in this house in North Perth. There's a few people who remember that place. And I had to teach the Dharma school for the kiddies, you know, the children of some of the Buddhists there. And they were 9, 10, 11, 12. It was, a very difficult task. You know, I'd never taught meditation to kids that age before. But at least I had the training to always innovate. One thing I did know about young people, teenagers as well, especially the younger teenagers, the 13 or 14 maybe, that their intellectual abilities haven't developed yet, but their imagination is huge. Kids can imagine. So instead of teaching people to watch their breath, I taught them this beautiful imaginary exercise. This was in North Perth, okay, about 30 years ago. I said, okay, sitting down in this little room, there's about 8 or 9 of them. Close your eyes, relax the body, relax, relax, relax. Now imagine yourself, I'm going quite quickly, floating out of your body and going over to the beach. Because, you know, kids love the beach in Western Australia. Going out past the beach, you can see your friends playing by the beach and in the surf. Go way out into the ocean to your place, your private place, and you just fall into that water. It's just warm and still and calm. You look around and there's no one else around, no ships, no other people, no parents, no teachers. This is your special place. And there's a beautiful, warm, soft breeze coming over the ocean. And you don't have to struggle at all. You can float and relax in this beautiful, warm, salty water. And the sun is not too hot, not too cold, it's just right. And I go on like this for about 10 or 15 minutes. And they're right there. You can tell that they're not wandering off or snoring or anything else. They're just right there enjoying every moment of this beautiful visualization. And then after 50 minutes, now's the time. You float out, say goodbye to your place in the ocean, your special place. You'll come back there later, floating up out of your body. Over the ocean, you can see Perth in the distance, going towards the shore. Now over the beach where all these people are playing around. Over to North Perth, into this little Buddhist center, through the roof and back into your bodies. You're home again. Now open your eyes. And I thought that, you know, that was good for 13-year-olds and 8, 9, 10-year-olds. But some of these people I still know, they come and see me every now and again. And they say, we still do the same meditation. Now we're 40 now with kids. And they still do it. Another well done. And that's the emotional intelligence which we managed to, you know, give those kids. And it was their meditation, did it every week, and they really got into it, and they managed to do it by themselves. And this is actually how a little bit of meditation to teenagers is so fantastic. Actually, I must say that one of those kids, his sister came and told me this, there was a competition on the TV called Iron Chef. He competed in it, and he won. I think his sister said he was the only sort of non-professional who ever won that competition. And I can understand why, because he got that emotional intelligence from our Buddhist society many years ago. To compete, you know, his sister was telling him, you know, she was more nervous than he was, you know, in the audience watching, you know, her younger brother compete. And to compete at such a high level, it's not what you learn in school. None of those kids did well at school, but their emotional intelligence was way up there, and he succeeded. He's married, got kids, and have a wonderful little life. Good on him. So this is actually how those teachings, you know, equip our young people. The tiredness of their life, they can relax, and they can like themselves, and be at peace with themselves. Not every girl would, you know, look like some supermodel. And so I really feel for girls, just, you know, if they're not drop-dead gorgeous, they think that they're second class. You ain't second class. That's just outside. You can always be incredibly kind, trustworthy, and fun. That is what makes you attractive. And just the guys, you know, you may not be the top sports jock in the school and not be sort of, you know, the fun guy, you know, but you can still just, you know, develop sort of those great skills which I've been talking about, and you can get your partner. You can feel good about yourself, and other people feel good about you too. And that is the spirituality. That's what spirituality is supposed to do to you, to overcome that inner suffering and an external suffering in life. That's all the Buddha ever taught, to overcome suffering, the suffering of teenagers. So it's not just teaching kids, you know, to bow to your parents every morning in Sri Lanka. You know, that is not good enough. You need to have much more to equip your children, not just with the old customs. Yeah, they're okay. But to know what's the heart of this Buddhist teachings? And to equip your kids sometimes to be strong enough to make their own decisions. Because sometimes if they're so scared of their parents and always do what their parents say, then they'll always be scared of authority. And their authority is their peers. And if their peers say, yeah, let's go out and take some dope, some drugs, some ice, they won't have the strength to say no. Basically, they've been cowed by the authority of their parents. Anyone who's on authority, they will follow. And you know, in life, there comes a time when we have to be strong enough to make our own decisions, and no one else is around to help us. And you know, people get put in those positions. You know, they're with some friends at school. Parents aren't around, monks aren't around, no one's around, just them. And say, you know, I've got some ice, would you like to try some? Methamphetamines. Would you like to try, you know, some whiskey, cigarettes, whatever else it is. How are your kids ever going to be strong enough to say no? If they've never been allowed and encouraged to grow in their own decision-making skills, give them emotional intelligence, and then they have to learn to make decisions and take responsibility. That's an important thing. It's a hard thing. But it's the only thing that we can equip our kids to do. Which is one of the reasons why now I'm going to go into another old story, which is a very wonderful story. Years and years and years and years and years and years ago, one of these monks, actually is an interesting monk, I think it was, if I got it right, it was Ajahn Amaro. Very interesting monk, just tell his little story. He's now the abbot of a monastery in England. But I was there when he first came to our temple. He just, this is totally by the way, but it's an interesting character. He came to monastery, first of all, he just finished his degree, I think it was in psychology. And finishing his degree in London, he had a friend of a friend of a friend who was exporting racehorses to Singapore. And the rule was, if you had a racehorse going in one of the flights to Singapore, you were allowed about three or four grooms, and they only really needed one. And they had a spare ticket. Do you want a one-way ticket to Singapore for free? And so, you know, he knew one end of a horse from another, so he could, you know, the front end, even I know that, so he could actually just get a job as a groom just on this flight. And so he had a free trip to Singapore and decided to work his way back, you know, after university, have a bit of a holiday. And so from Singapore, he went north into Thailand, and in Bangkok, he met a couple of English people who were working in the refugee camp of Ubon in northeast Thailand. So why don't you come up here? Not many people come up here. So he went up to there with these doctors, and when he was in this place, there was no other Westerners around, except in this monastery. There's a few Western monks in this monastery. I was one of those Western monks at that time. So he said, I'll just go for a look. So he went for a look, and he liked it enough. He asked the abbot, can I spend the night? So he got permission to spend the night. He wasn't a Buddhist. You know, he was just a student, a backpacker. He spent the night there. In the morning, he shaved his own head and begged to be a monk. It was an incredible experience, just no preparation at all. And 12 hours after he first came into a Buddhist monastery, the first Buddhist he ever saw, you know, he wanted to become a monk, and he's been a monk for about 30 years now. And interestingly, sort of, it comes from a very interesting family, because I remember his lay name, Jeremy Horner, and They said Hornock. I knew that name. He was the head of the Pali Text Society. Pali is a Buddhist language, and there's this professor over in Cambridge who was translating all these Buddhist books. And I said, are you any relation of hers? He said, no, I've never heard of her. When he went home, he checked out with his father, and it was his father's sister. His auntie. And they never said anything about her because she was like a black sheep of the family. It's a very secretive family. I think I won't get into too much trouble because this is way out there. I said it to one of the people this afternoon in Bodhinyana Monastery. And this Ajahn Amro, he has a sister. His sister recently retired from her job in London. And Ajahn Amro thought, you know, she was just got some secretarial job in London somewhere. But it turned out all those years, his sister was an agent for MI5. She was working for MI5 in London, and the man never knew anything about it. It was because of that that I started actually saying, oh, I better make my confession. You know, all these times I go overseas, you know. It's a perfect cover for a secret agent, a monk. You know, when I go overseas, I always go by myself. No, I'm not MI5, but even if I was MI5, I would say that anyway. But anyway, this, I've got to go back to the topic of the talk. You have a really interesting life as a monk. You get all these little stories from all over the place. Don't ever think that being a monk is boring. You know, it's incredible sort of people you meet and just what goes on. So actually, there's one lady who comes here. She, I haven't seen her for a while. She used to work for the KGB. Honest. You know, I think she migrated. And she told you some great stories about working for the KGB and the Prague Bureau. She comes here. But that's the old life, you know, some great stories. But anyway, let's go back to what was the story? Ajahn Amro, yes. Someone asked him once, and I think this was his brilliant answer. They asked him, we just had a child. How should we bring up our child? Should we make them a Buddhist? Because we're Buddhist parents. Or should we make them a Christian because we live in a Christian country? Or should we expose them to all the faiths or none of the faiths? What should we do? Because this is a problem with parents. You know, you want to raise a kid, but how can you raise a kid? And this monk gave this beautiful answer, which I keep repeating to others. If you have a kid, you don't need to raise them as a Buddhist or a Christian or an atheist or whatever. Please raise them to be honest, number one. To respect the truth that much, they're not going to stop at sort of some religion or some part of religion which doesn't make any sense. That honesty, that commitment to truth. And number two, encourage them to question. Always question. So again, they won't be fooled by people selling them a dud car or a dud religion or a dud spirituality. Question honesty. And the great qualities to encourage in a kid. And that's, of course, what we want to try and encourage in a teenager. So when your teenager starts questioning, please give them answers. Even if you say, I don't know, it's all right to say you don't know. But you can actually tell them how to find out. And of course, that's how we're equipping a person. Tell them to keep questioning. Because that questioning will be what will give them that inner strength to resist the pressures from authoritarians, and I'm talking about their peers, the tough guys, the tough girls in their group, which want to get them into doing really stupid things. That honesty, that strength, this is wrong. I know this is wrong. I won't do it. That is such an important thing to encourage in our teenagers. It's encouraging to you as well. Because so often, peer pressure, or everyone else does it. What the heck? Everyone else doesn't doing their tax returns properly, so well, yeah, it's just everybody. Why not? No, please be honest. Please be truthful. Question until you can find that truth. But that will give you that inner strength. And it's so important for teenagers to have that inner strength. So if it's always just, no, yeah, no, don't just think for yourself. Don't question. Always follow what mum says, what dad says. I know better than you. Have you done that before? And of course, what happens? You're not equipping the kid. It's hard to have the kid question you and challenge you. And that's why it's hard for me to have all these people coming up afterwards with their questions and challenges. And it's hard for me as the teacher in the monastery. It looks like we're going to have 23 monks this year at monastery and lots of other people staying in the Jhana Grove and other places. And they always want to question me. And it's always tough, you know, saying, why are you always questioning me? Question, question, question. But the alternative is say, I am Ajahn Brahm, the infallible. You must believe what I say. If it comes from my mouth, you must follow it. It'd be nice to do that, but that'd be just totally dysfunctional. That'd be a cult. Even though we do joke, we have two rules in our monastery. You know, this monk knows the two rules. We mentioned them the other day. The first rule, monastic rule, is the abbot, which is me, is always right. And the second rule, if he's wrong, go back to rule number one. That's a joke, okay? That's not how monastery works. But is that how the family works? Is that the rules of your family? I don't know who's ahead of your family, maybe the mother or the father. Mother is always right, kids. And if mother is wrong, you know, go back to rule number one. Mother is always right. That's a very easy way to live a life in the short term. But the long term, you're not actually bringing up teenagers to take responsibility, to learn for themselves, and to get that inner strength of honesty and questioning, to actually know for themselves, this is wrong, it hurts, it's not a good thing to do. That questioning is important. But it's not just questioning, the honesty there, the integrity, that sense of, you know, the knowledge of, you know, what's good, what's bad, what's right, what's wrong, what's appropriate, what's not appropriate. That is something which teenagers want to learn. It's a job of parents to give them the way to learn, not to tell them. And that's one of the great things which I loved about Buddhism. We'll never tell you what the truth is. It'll always tell you how to find out. Do the meditation, the mindfulness. Strong mental powers, you know, through meditation. So you can see the truth for yourself. See what's actually inside of you. See what the meaning of this life is. Okay, it's very easy for a monk to come along or a nun to come along and tell you what the meaning of life is, what nibbana is, you know, what you're supposed to be doing in life, but does that really help you? This monk says one thing one week, another monk says another thing another week, then a nun comes along, then somebody else comes along. It's just so confusing. So what is really important, we tell you how to find out. And that's exactly how we tell our teenagers as well. Not what to believe, but how to find out. With that meditation, this beautiful precepts which we have. You know, so many people, again, in Sri Lanka, I just was there because it's very recently, how many people in Sri Lanka keep the five precepts? They all take the five precepts. Even I'm telling the government people, you all keep the five precepts. You're up right there in front of you, had all these big government people. You know, your president wasn't there, he was over in Bolivia, but his wife, his son, his brother, all taking the precepts, Parnati Pata, where am I? But how many of them actually keeping it? What use is it doing the chanting if you're actually honest enough to actually to do it? Doesn't make any sense to me. And that lack of integrity, that lack of strength, if we don't impart that to our children, not only will they be having trouble with drugs and alcohol and all this other stuff which besets our youth, you haven't given them that strength. But then later on in life, I don't know, they become whatever. I just read in the paper that, was it the Commonwealth Bank or something is in trouble for, I better be careful, they'll probably get sued. Actually, I don't get sued, the Buddhist Society gets sued. So I'm sorry. But anyway, somebody got done for financial irregularities. Why is there so much fraud and corruption in our world? And it's because we're not teaching people to know the honesty and to have trust in that honesty and see the results of the goodness in the world. Law of karma, you can see that very easily. There's so many little instances of when you are kind, you get something beautiful back. When you're generous, you get things back. Just when you're just a good person, you have a much happier life. It's so easy to see that we can teach our kids that, our teenagers that, and give them the purpose, the meaning of being a good person. Just simple things, being trustworthy, being kind, being fun, makes you more attractive to the other gender. That's a pretty good incentive to teenagers. Not only that, it creates much more happiness for you in your life. You can see that. So that is a sort of a spirituality, you know, in Buddhism for teenagers, which makes sense. And when you do that, like I did when I was a school teacher or when I teaching meditation, you know, one of those kids, I saw them years later, I was visiting England, and this happens to you again and again and again when you get to my age. Someone comes up to you, "Do you remember me?" Oh, please, look, you know, I was on Sri Lanka, 10,000 people came to my talk, and one of them comes, "Do you remember me? I was at your talk in Mahavagama." Look, there's 10,000 of you, how am I going to remember you? So this guy came up to me, "Do you remember me?" And said, "No, who the hell are you?" Monks have to be honest. He's saying, "I was one of those kids you taught meditation to at that school." And he said, "I came up to say it changed my whole life." And it's amazing, just simple things you totally forget. And little things change a whole person's life. It's amazing just how some spirituality can take somebody and just move them in such a different direction in their life. Grieving someone who's committed suicide, losing sort of their job, getting cancer, whatever it is in their life, you can take a person and just a beautiful teaching of spirituality can take so much pain away which medicines can never take away. It's incredible the power of this teaching. So that's why it's great to share that with our teenagers. Vulnerable, sort of looking for something to shore up their lives, give them meaning. And that way that our teenagers can become really, really happy people. People you can be proud of. And having known all those teenagers I've been teaching for such a long time, and people like who come to Kalyana Mitra Group and stuff like that, you really get really proud of them. And I've been a monk for such a long time, known you for such a long time. Some of these people that are my, well, I'm a lot more like a godfather to them, part of the family, and I'm very proud to be their monk. When they say that, "You're my monk." It's like, you know, grandfather, grandmother, uncle, another part of the family. And I'm really proud of that, so you can really help out and serve and look after. And we've got many other family monks and nuns to help and serve your teenagers. So when it's like that, our teenagers have a wonderful life. Mum and dad are happy. Teenagers live a beautiful life, really rich, fulfilling, meaningful. And the monks, your monks and nuns here, get this real big happiness in their heart. We've helped. Thank you for listening. So, very good. Okay, we're getting some questions from overseas. And then questions from inside the room later. Only one question again, from England. "I have a lot of hostility developed through too much negativity and threat when I was young." Yeah. "I am a man now and need to abandon it, but I'm not getting anywhere." Okay, then this is the problem when, as teenagers' years, that we are treated badly. It's not really badly. This person, Morgan from England, look, what happened to you was people didn't really know what they were doing. Maybe parents, teachers, friends, you know, they were just as deluded as most ordinary people, so they didn't mean it. It's not intentional. When I say that, it means you can start to give some compassion and forgiveness to your past. If you think that someone really meant it, they did it on purpose, it's very hard to forgive. But when you give people the benefit of the doubt, they may have been crazy. They thought it was the only thing they could do. They thought it was the right thing to do. They were wrong, but that's what they thought. They thought they were trying to do the best for you. Even stretch it so far to give them the slightest benefit of the doubt. Because when you give people the benefit of the doubt, it's easier to forgive, to let go. And that's what I meant by softening your past. What compassion does there's no dog. The dog barks, that's what it does. Sometimes a dog bites. Why did it bite? Maybe because it was very badly treated when it was young. And so if I see a dog like that, biting and barking, you know, you realize it's not a bad dog. It's a dog which has been badly treated. And then that's an example of how I can forgive and let go. And so it doesn't sort of stay with me day after day, year after year. So learning how to, what I call softening the past with compassion, with forgiveness, benefit of the doubt to people. You made a mistake, yeah. You know, you thought it was the best thing at the time. You know, it was a stupid thing you did. But two bad bricks in the wall doesn't make you a stupid person because you did a bad thing. So please give yourself the benefit of the doubt. Why you did that, the situation you were put in, difficult circumstances, I don't know why. But then when you give that type of compassion and softness, compassion is what forgives, what can understand, what can see the bigger picture. Compassion sees the 998 good bricks, not just the bad bricks. And that means you can forgive and let go, just like I could let go of my wall. The two bad bricks, that was obsessing me for months, literally. Give me so much negativity, and it was my fault, stupid monk. And when I sort of gave it some compassion, oh, it's okay, it's only a wall. There's 998 good bricks, that's a pretty good job. And then that meant when I softened that past, the wall vanished. You know, for years I didn't know where it was. I it just dropped from my memory. People would come and say, where's your wall? We want to take a photo of it. I've forgotten where it was. I think it's over in the ablution block now, the monks' toilets. But, you know, you can't go down there anyway, so. So that is actually how to do it. Please, compassion, the kindness which you'd have, you know, to someone you love very much, or maybe to a pet. Sometimes human beings can find it much easier to have compassion to a dog or to a little cat than they can to a human being. But at least you know what compassion is, kindness. If you have a little, say, dog and it poos on your carpet, yeah, you're a bit upset, but you know, you don't kill the dog. You know, it's just what dogs do. And so, you know, you're kind to it. And so then you can forgive it and let it go. It's just a dog. It may have been sick. In the same way that you can do that to your past. Soften it with compassion. You can't just say, I'm going to let it go. Let it go. Get out of here. Go! It's got to be softened first of all. And then it's easy to let go. I hope that helped. But it's obviously, it's much better if we don't have those bad experiences when we're young. Remember what I said today, is this really great insight. This comes from kids. Revelation. Their biggest emotional problem is their tiredness. Maybe he didn't understand that before, but now he mentioned it, and oh yeah, I can understand. It's one of the reasons why they get angry and grumpy. Tiredness, that's all. Okay, any questions from here? Going. Ah, quick one, Peter.
Yeah, I came bottom in maths, and the teacher like singled me out and embarrassed me in front of the whole class. It didn't help.
Yeah, that's a very silly thing to do for a teacher. Because again, especially when you're very young, you know, you want sort of acceptance from your peers. And when a teacher does that, it's just very, 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 very dysfunctional. They think they may be punishing you, but it punishes people for life when that happens. Now, I remember this one of the monks, I won't say who he is, but his grandfather one day called him stupid because, you know, he didn't do well at school. And from that day on, I mean, he's one of the monks, you know, you talk to him, counsel him, just get to know him really, really well. From that time on, he thought he was stupid. And he never really did well at school. And he sort of left school early, got a job as a cook or something. And, you know, to see him as a monk, he's incredibly intelligent. You give him a job to do, and he does it to such a high standard. And I asked him afterwards, what was going on here? Why did you go to university? You know, you're smart enough. I was a teacher. I know smart people. And that's what he said, oh, because he believed he was stupid. He believed his grandfather so much. He respected him so much. When his grandfather said he was stupid, he thought he was stupid. And he literally became stupid. And it took him a long while to realize his grandfather was wrong. He is intelligent. But that stopped him sort of, you know, going to university. It's actually probably a good thing. If he went to university, he probably would never become a monk. But, you know, it's still a nasty thing to do. So don't ever do that. Because it's amazing, just little teenagers, they believe what you say much more than you think. They are listening to you. And they want their sort of respect and love and a bit of a boost from their parents. Because they don't get that anywhere else. Don't think they get it from their friends. They just get more criticism from their friends.
Excuse me. Yeah. I have a good news story for you. It's not so much a question. I'm a teacher, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's quite a lot of teachers in this room, actually.
Yeah.
And just a comment on what we value.
Yeah.
Throughout my school, we've got safety, respect, and responsibility, and it's very much about instilling that in respect for yourself and for other people,
good.
And responsibility for your actions,
good.
And for supporting each other, and creating an emotionally safe environment as well.
Yeah.
So just on a positive note, I think schools are a lot more aware, about being sensitive to criticism, public criticism as well. We always try and have private conversations rather than public embarrassment.
Very good.
And we also do meditation.
Yeah, so very good.
And it's not, but you know, I'm conscious of not making it particularly religious, but there's a lot of high-need kids, and they really benefit from
it. They benefit from it enormously. But against all that, you still got the Year 11 and Year 12 university entrance exams.
That's true, but I'm in primary, and I'm already preparing
our
Year 6 sevens for that, and getting them aware about strategies for stress management. And
yeah, it's very good, but it's a shame we can't do the same things in high schools. Primary schools are pretty neat. We sometimes lose it in high schools.
It's changing.
Changing, yes. We get there, but maybe we have the time when 30-40% of your score is over the whole class. We can have an emotional test. So, you know, we can. Meditation can be one of the TE subjects. I don't know. But anyway, very, very good.
What if you can see someone's. Sorry. What if you can see someone's 998 good bricks? And they can see yours, but they tend to focus on your two bad bricks. How can you teach them to focus on the good bricks when they're in an angry mood?
Yeah, so that's when you have
the
to
worst get... mood.
Okay, that's when you have to get them to come to the Buddhist Society of West Australia on a Friday evening. Sometimes people just go through those. Times, and you just have to let them just vent. They're tired, they're angry, they're upset, and sometimes they want to do that to you because they care for you, they love you. It's a really weird stuff, but we always tend to sort of let go on the people we love because we think they can understand. I'm not getting angry at you, it's just that I was so angry, I'm going to get angry at somebody, and you're the safest one to get angry at. So let them vent, and don't criticize them. Show them by example. Give them a big hug afterwards if you possibly can, if it's your partner or your kid. They can just get very angry at you, but after a while you can soften them. To see your good bricks, you have to really highlight them. But you know they'll see your bad bricks for a while because that's just what they want to for a while. They're in a bad mood. But eventually you find out that's what happens. The other thing is that they're in a bad mood because they can't sort of let go of their past. Something might have happened to today. So, very quick, that really brilliant story, which is probably was the reason why they vent at you. The two chicken farmers, you know that story. Two chicken farmers, the first chicken farmer goes into the shed early in the morning, collect the produce of the night before, they collect the shit and bring the shit back into the house with them. They leave the eggs in the shed to rot. Stupid chicken farmer. Second chicken farmer goes into the shed, and gets the eggs, brings the eggs back into the house, and leaves the shit in the shed to rot, becomes fertilizer later, but you don't bring it into the house with you. And brings the eggs into the house, makes an omelette for the family, sells the rest of the eggs in the market for cash. That's a smart chicken farmer. Whenever I tell that story, I say, what type of chicken farmer are you? Do you collect the eggs of life, or do you collect the shit of life? People are laughing because those are the shit collectors just laughed. I nailed them. And that's why we get angry at each other. Something happened, you got done by the police for speeding, or, you know, that somebody in the office just really sort of scolded you or something. And that's what you bring back. And so, you know, these little stories, especially so we can only collect, if we're going to collect the past, collect the beautiful stuff of the past. Leave the shit to rot in the past, whatever happened to you. There's beautiful memories you had. You know, there was a lady here earlier, you know, her partner just committed suicide last week. You can collect that shit into your future and carry that around it with you. Or you can let it rot in the past and carry the eggs, the beautiful times you had with your partner, the years of happiness and joy you spent together. That's what you should carry with you into the future. Be the egg collector, never the shit collector. And if you're a person like that, or if you teach the other person like that, they won't just see your two bad bricks. They won't collect those things. They'll collect the eggs instead. That's an old story, but it's very powerful. And please spread that one around, because that really works. You say it in a story like that, people remember it. You know, it's a bit funny, and you can tell it to other people. Tell people don't just let go of the bad stuff of the past. They can't do it. Stories really help. Okay, so thank you again. I hope that helped. But we'll see. So let's pay respects to Buddha Dhamma Sangha now.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantā abhivādhe. Suvākkhāto bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi. Supatipanno bhagavato savakasangho sanghaṃ namāmi.